This is Your Money with Nancy Snedden of BDO, Licensed Insolvency Trustees. The views and opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of this station. Your Money with Nancy Snedden of BDO on VOCM.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Your Money with Nancy Snedden. I am Nancy Snedden. Thanks so much for tuning in today. On today's show, we're focusing on money, how we feel about it, and as well as our behavior when it comes to money. So have you ever paused to think about your money behavior and the reasons for it? Why you may be a saver, why you may be a spender? Why do you tie so much of your self-worth to your finances or the balance in your bank account? Money definitely evokes many emotions, but why? Well, my guest today is here to share her insight into what it's all about and why money makes us behave and feel certain ways. She's the CEO and co-founder of The Trauma of Money, an accredited course certifying professionals in trauma-aware and trauma-informed approaches to finances. She's a finance expert, 14 years as a mortgage broker, a decade as financial literacy consultant, and she's researched, taught, and written personal and entrepreneurial curriculums for various organizations, universities, and accelerator programs, among them Wilfrid Laurier and Simone Fraser Universities, Humber College, United Way, American Psychology Association, and more. She's played a key role in the development of digital finance products for several of the country's leading fintech brands, and her work has been featured in the New York Times, Real Simple Magazine, Refinery 29, and media outlets across the country. Chantelle Chapman, thank you for joining me today, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You definitely have an impressive resume. And I know when I've heard you spoke, you know, it's been really riveting just to hear like all the insights that you have around money and like the trauma around money, right? What the impact it has on people's, I guess, mental health, right? So before we get into, because I know we have so much to talk about today, maybe you could share with our listeners a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, for sure. I think maybe after listening to that resume, it would appear that I've always been absolutely perfect with money, and that's definitely not the case. Even though I taught financial literacy for many years, I still had a lot of patterns around money that were very unhelpful, such as overspending, a significant amount of credit card debt, what we call financial avoidance. I would say I would always use my money like a please love and accept me fund. And it was because of these behaviors happening and my in-depth knowledge of financial literacy and nothing adjusting that I actually went down the path of exploring financial psychology and then trauma and then addiction recovery and bringing all of this together with an incredible faculty of experts.
Yeah, it's really an interesting topic. I can see why you spent so much time researching it. You know, you have something called the trauma of money, right? And what it's what you do. So your decision to use trauma as part of your identity, what is the tie in there between the two, trauma and money?
One of the psychologist that works in the trauma space, what he says about trauma is we name it to tame it. So this is why we use the language trauma right in the title, because through the research that we've done, we've seen that trauma can impact the relationship with money. And I know it's a big sounding word, but when we talk about the word trauma, what we're meaning is a wounding that happened at some point in the lifetime that has impacted our sense of security and our sense of worth. And what does money represent in our society? It represents security and worth. So if we have wounding in these two areas, all different types of trauma has the ability to impact our relationship with money.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I can, like, I know in my work, Chantelle, like I see people all the time who have all kinds of emotion, right, around money. It's usually around debt, but it's still money at the end of the day, right? It's their finances. So what is it about money that stirs up so many emotions? And what is it about the life events and the impact that it has on our behaviors when it comes to money?
Well, I mean, we live in a dominant economic culture where one of the values of shame, systemic shame or financial shame, is power over others through financial wealth. So that's just one narrative that shows up around money. So the more money you have, the more power you might have. That's only one narrative. There's so many other narratives that show up, such as the way you spend your money. And even in the financial literacy world, there's a lot of advice that is like, you do this, you're good, you do that, you're bad. And financial literacy in itself, depending on how it's presented, can actually lead to financial shame. So when we're experiencing money, we don't just experience it from our lens only. We're experiencing it from the lens of applying societal narratives, cultural narratives, the way we grew up around money. There's so many layers that show up that impact the way we interact with money, that create narratives, that create emotions that then lead to behaviors that might be helpful or unhelpful around money.
And you mentioned financial shame, and that's obviously something that I see, you know, talking to my clients. It's one of the reasons it takes them so long to reach out for help, right? Because they are feeling that shame of getting themselves into the situation. Although it's usually a life event, right, that's led them to where they are. But if we talk about, like, if we dive a little deeper, I guess, into that sort of financial shame, because Coast Capital released a survey and it showed that 1/3 of Canadians say they are in a cycle of financial shame. So maybe you could speak more about this and the reasons behind it, because there's so many reasons that people may not even be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. I was not surprised when I saw that research from Coast Capital. I actually thought 1/3 was a little bit low. And, you know, it's probably higher because a lot of people do not like to talk or identify their financial shame. So the 1/3 we heard from is the people that arrived at a place where they were willing to even identify it. Financial shame can come from many places, very similar to where trauma comes from. We look at it as coming from generational shame, relational shame, societal shame, or systemic shame. And it is a very, very big feeling. So financial shame is more identity-based. So it would look like this. I am bad with money across the board versus having guilt, which would be like, I have credit card debt. I feel bad about that. But you know what? I'm really good at negotiations around money. Shame is identity-based. Across the board, I'm bad with money. And it's a really big feeling. It feels at its core like the threat of abandonment. And this can feel like life or death for some people. And that's why it makes so much sense of what you're saying, that people wait a very long time before they may seek support in debt recovery.
Yeah, and I mean, we hear from our clients all the time, you know, I should have reached out to you a year ago, or I wish I'd reached out to you 2 years ago. Like, they've been struggling for so long. And just, you know, some of it is not knowing where to turn, like what the options would be, how it's going to impact them. But largely, it's because they're worried about judgment, or they're feeling shame about having to reach out for help. I think another important statistic that came out of that survey is that it shows that nearly 2/3, at 63% of Canadians, take some sort of measure to avoid dealing with their finances. So some of these measures include postponing financial goals, avoiding discussing finances with family and friends, and avoiding situations that involve purchasing decisions, including paying their bills. So when you look at these behaviors, why is it that you think people are responding this way? Because it can really lead to a negative cycle, right? One that just repeats and repeats, or puts you in a worse financial situation that you have feeling even worse about your situation. And of course, leading then to unhealthy financial behaviors.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we see financial shame, we typically see two unhelpful patterns of behavior that arise out of financial shame. One is avoidance, which you can see in that Coast Capital data. And then the next is some sort of compulsive behavior, such as overspending or hoarding, gambling, essentially like an overconsumption. Now, what both of these pathways of behaviors are doing is they're soothing the nervous system. They're giving the brain and the body a little bit of a rest from this cycle of shameful thoughts. And you're right. The problem is that these soothing behaviors, or these behaviors that people are choosing to resource themselves, because that's what they're trying to do. They're like, I'm in a lot of pain right now. This shame is so overwhelming. I just need a break. How can I resource myself? They're choosing these pathways. These pathways are resources that can lead to negative consequences and put us on what we call the destructive shame cycle. So let's say I'm feeling shame about, you know, maybe my debt. And so I'm just going to avoid my finances and not even look at it. And then the bills keep piling up. I notice my credit score's dropping. All these things happen because of the avoidance. And then what happens? I feel more shame. And now this shame is feeling like so much. I'm in so much pain. I'm going to go do something to like give myself a break. I'm going to go buy myself something just to get that increase of dopamine and feel better in the moment. Well, now I added more to my credit card, and it's just this continuous destructive cycle.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it is something you see a lot. You hear people like it's retail therapy, right? It makes them feel better to go out, but it's not helping the situation. In many cases, it's hurting the situation. So I think, you know, as important as to talk about, you know, that this is out there and that people are experiencing it, it's also important, I think, for people to become more aware. So like, what are the red flags that people should be aware of? So we're going to get into that when we come back. Please stay with us.
Saturday morning, join us for the Irish Newfoundland Show. Send your request to IrishNL@VOCM.com or submit them online at VOCM.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Money here on VOCM. I'm your host, Nancy Sneddon, licensed insolvency trustee with BDO Canada, right here in Newfoundland and Labrador. My guest today is Chantelle Chapman. She's the CEO and co-founder of The Trauma of Money. And we're talking about money trauma and how it impacts your financial and psychological health. And we were talking about before the break, you know, how people have this shame and it can become a bit of a cycle. So Chantelle, I'd like you to talk to people a little bit about what are the red flags that they should be aware of, signs that indicate that this behavior is due to money trauma. And I guess, how can you become more self-aware of these behaviors? And more importantly, I guess, your advice on managing them.
Yeah, we always actually use financial shame as an indicator of potentially trauma or trauma of money present. And some of the red flags or the indicators of financial shame would be things like isolation. Shame loves to have us move into a place of isolation, thinking that we're the only ones with this issue. This is actually why I absolutely love to hear any research data around financial shame, because it just shows like you are not alone in this. So many people are going through the same experience. And then another indicator of financial shame is having like a perfectionism lens when it comes to your money. Anytime you get into that very rigid, I have to be absolutely perfect with money, that could also be an indicator of financial shame, or underneath that, trauma. Some other indicators could be behaviors that we have with money that are unhelpful that we do over and over and over again. So some of these might be financial avoidance patterns. This might be rejecting money consciously or subconsciously. So the way we can reject money is never negotiating on our behalf, not asking for a raise. Anytime we receive money, it's hard for us to hold on to it or save it. We just kind of spend it all really quickly. Another behavior could be compulsive spending. So this is where we get pleasure or a little bit of a distraction from the act of buying. But once we have something and have the thing that we buy, we're not so much interested in it. It's all about the chase and the buy. Others could be gambling, extensive risk-taking, financial infidelity, financial codependency, all these types of behaviors. If we're doing them in a pattern, it could be an indication of trauma as the underlying issue.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me, like all these different things. So if people are recognizing some of these behaviors in themselves, what's the best way that they can, or so I guess some of the ways that they can look to manage them?
Well, you know, there's a doctor from Vancouver, and he does a lot of work around addiction recovery. And he said something really interesting about addiction recovery pathways. So he says that, let's say someone has a substance use addiction and they go on a recovery journey. If they're only treating the substance use and they don't look at why someone decided to use the substance in the first place, they're not usually going to have good results with their recovery. This is the exact same thing with money. So if we only focus on the secondary issue, which would be the behavior around money, and we don't look at the primary issue, which is the trauma, we're not going to have long-term results. And this is exactly what I had experienced with money. I thought that financial literacy and, you know, shifting maybe the behavior around money could change my whole relationship with money. But if I ignored the source of why I was seeking out avoidance behaviors or why I was seeking out overspending, I don't have long-term impact or long-term change. And that root is typically trauma.
Yeah, and I think that's true of so many things, right? Like you often hear people talking of things like a Band-Aid solution, right? You're not actually addressing the root cause. So you're not actually going to see the long-term solutions, right, that you need for the thing that you're trying to fix. I think it's interesting, too, that research shows that financial well-being begins with the thoughts, feelings, and attitudes and beliefs that are driving the relationship we have with money and, of course, ourselves. And Chantel, I think this is a really big one because the relationship between money or our finances and our self-worth is something that people connect, right? They connect, you know, how they are with their money or their finances, you know, what their net worth is somehow connected to their self-worth. A lot of people really tie these together. So why do you think that is?
Yeah, before I answer that, I just want to go back to what I said, what I was talking about earlier, when I said some of the times the root cause can be trauma. I just want to really reinforce that that root cause can be systemic and societal trauma as well. And oftentimes people can take on this very like individualistic view when it comes to money, which is linked to the question that you just asked now, thinking that it's fully their responsibility. It's fully maybe a representation of only their self-worth, when in all reality, we do live in a dominant economic culture that has a lot of there's not a lot of equity, and there's a lot of systems that exist in this economic culture that we live in that elevate some and can marginalize many other people. So this is a form of trauma, and this can actually leave someone feeling like they have a low self-worth when the problem is not in here, it's actually out there. So that's really important to kind of start off saying when we talk about self-worth. But then, of course, there is experiences that someone can have through trauma that does impact their sense of self. And when there is a wounding around self or around worth, when we have to interact with something that represents value, and worth, of course, we can have some challenges in it. And then if we go back to societal programming, for example, over generations, men have been told that their value is associated with how much they can provide. And when it comes to money, that narrative can be placed on people. And if they feel like they don't have enough or they can't give enough financially, that can directly impact the way that they look at their own worth. Also, folks who've experienced relational trauma in childhood, so maybe attachment trauma with their caretaker, can impact their sense of worth. And that can manifest in all sorts of ways with money, such as not being able to advocate for yourself, not being able to negotiate, constantly feeling like you have to overgive, or having an overdeveloped sense of responsibility for others rather than taking care of your own needs.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like, because I do see that, right? Like, people feel bad about themselves, right? Which tells me that their self-worth is low, and it's directly tied to where they are with regards to their finances. So for you, when you hear a client or someone commenting on their value and you know that it's tied to money, how do you respond to them?
One thing, I work a lot with entrepreneurs, and we actually hear this a lot, even from like business coaches, charge your worth. And I always laugh because I was like, if you were going to charge your worth, even Jeff Bezos couldn't afford what you're selling. Because your worthiness is just infinite. It's so big, and we should not be attaching our worth as a human being to anything financial, because it absolutely does not make sense. So I always like to point that out and move the focus away from correlating our personal worth to our financial net worth or the price of things or the value of things.
Chantal, you know, if this is something that people are feeling, right, they feel that they are tying their value to their net worth, right, their self-worth to their net worth, I'm guessing it can be a bit of a cycle, right? So if someone is regularly doing that, can they be financially self-sabotaging?
Yeah, absolutely. So when someone is consistently doing that, it can be a little bit of a perfectionist lens, because you're all of a sudden creating this very, very high standard of the way you have to show up, which actually comes from a lack of self-worth. And the perfectionist approach to anything is a setup, because essentially what perfectionism will have us do is end it up in this like wheel of perfectionism, procrastination, paralysis, which then puts us back into that shame cycle. So it's very hard. It's very, very important to divest from any sort of perfectionist lens or attaching your personal worth to a financial net worth. And one of the ways that we can look at doing that is to actually redefine wealth in other ways that are not correlated with money. So what are other ways that you can experience wealth that you value, that feel very worthy to you, that have nothing specifically to do with money? And do you have access to those things? So someone might say, well, I really value being able to go out in nature. I really value spending time with friends and family. I really value, and then just going through this list and reminding yourself of these are all the other different ways that you can access richness and abundance and wealth and value that are more in line with your innately worthy self.
Yeah, I love that. Like, I often talk to people about, you know, it's about quality, not perfection, right? Well, you don't need to strive for perfection. So it's quality of life, right? In this instance that you're looking for, and what are the ways that you can achieve that? Well, financial wellness is definitely a journey. And Chantal has some advice on how you can move forward if you've experienced issues with self-worth or money trauma. When we come back, we're going to get into that. Please stay with us.
Every Saturday is perfect for a night at the cabin. The Cabin Party with Brian O'Connell. Saturday night starting at 7 p.m. on VOCM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Money. I'm your host, Nancy Snedden, licensed insolvency trustee with BDO Canada, right here in Newfoundland and Labrador. My guest today is Chantal Chapman. She's the CEO and co-founder of The Trauma of Money. And we've been talking about money and its impact on our behaviors, our sense of security, and even our self-worth. So Chantal, when you consider all of this, it really is a powerful influence.
Yeah, it is.
So earlier in the show, we talked about money and how it can lead to these behaviors, how we spend and how we save and even how we invest. So I want to go a bit deeper now and focus on who we are as individuals and how our environment can play a role in our financial decision making. Because after all, many people may not consciously consider how their identity influences their decisions when it comes to how they're handling money. But it can all play a significant role in shaping our behavior, right? Our attitudes and the outcomes toward money and overall financial well-being, really. So being aware can be valuable in changing behavior and perspective. So it's worth noting that all of this ranges from upbringing and the values and beliefs that are taught within the household we grew up in. So life experiences, socioeconomic status, cultural background, and it just goes on and on. So Chantel, let's talk a little bit about this, and maybe you can share with our listeners behaviors that you may be associated with each.
Yeah, so in the trauma of money, we've created this model, and it basically is the answer to this question: what impacts our relationship with money? And on this model, there's six layers. So the first is generational trauma or scarcity. So we believe that any trauma or scarcity that your ancestral lineage has experienced has the ability to impact the relationship with money. The next is relational. So this is most related to your interactions with your caretakers in your childhood. And it can really also be any other important relationships in your life, which can really influence you and then lead to narratives around money, which then leads to behaviors. The next layer is societal. So this is looking at what are some of the influences and impacts on us from the society we live in. So in this layer, we talk about things like capitalism, we talk about patriarchy, racism, consumerism, colonialism. Consumerism is a very interesting societal influence that is a little bit more sneaky on how it impacts the relationship with money, because consumerism has this subtle message that tells us over and over again, pretty much all day long, if we're interacting with ads or the internet, is that if you ever feel bored, tired, lonely, sad, inadequate, something's wrong with you, you are defective, and you need to go fix yourself by consuming something right away. So even through that messaging, we're told that having emotions outside of excitement and being happy all the time is wrong. And, you know, we're told to deny those emotions, deny our human experience by consumption. And then the fourth layer is systemic trauma or scarcity. So this is acknowledging that in a society that is somewhat toxic in some areas, especially around money, there are systems that are created that cause trauma for people. And we've seen this even in the banking world, and how some folks are unbanked or unbanked, or how certain neighborhoods have predatory lenders strategically set up very in close proximity to low-income neighborhoods. So these are all like forms of systemic trauma. And then the next layer we call laws of nature. And this is where we acknowledge that a lot of the frameworks that exist from our dominant culture economic system are rooted in scarcity. So laws of nature is a reminder to look at other frameworks that are not rooted in scarcity to be our guides around money. And there's so many in nature. So for example, we love to talk a lot about the forests and the mycelium network and how they're always in collaboration with each other. They actually do a lot of mutual aid between each other. They're a framework rooted in abundance, and they also root in reciprocity. If we have an economic system that's rooted in a similar way, there would be a lot more people who are not suffering around money. The wealth gap, the gender wealth gap, the racial wealth gap would not be so large. And then the last layer that we believe impacts the relationship with money is financial literacy. But financial literacy is always last, because we believe that if you're in a state of trauma activation, or your brain believes it's in scarcity, or you're actually experiencing scarcity, it's very hard to engage with financial literacy.
Yeah, and of course, financial literacy is something that I'm very passionate about and try to get out in the community and talk about and educate people on, because I hear from people all the time, you know, I never learned this in school, or I never learned this growing up. And there's a lot of people out there that struggle with where to get that information, even though, you know, the internet is vast. Right. I think it's more of a trust thing and wanting to hear it from someone that they trust, as opposed to just reading from any sort of source online. But it is something that is very, very important. One of the other things that I've heard you talk about, and you mentioned it briefly in the first segment, is financial codependency. So debt for external validation and people pleasing. And research does show that women tend to experience this more than men. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we call these patterns of behaviors financial codependency or financial fawning. And this is where we essentially use our money like a please love and accept me fund, as I love to say. And this can show up in a variety of different ways. So this can show up through overspending. So all your overspending is somehow linked to receiving external validation or external acceptance. This can lead to any type of people pleasing with money. So, you know, picking up the tab when maybe you can't afford it. It can also show up as under earning by not being able to negotiate raises. If you have your own business, undercharging, constantly giving away discounts. It can show up through workaholism. And it can also show up through financial avoidance, because when you're constantly in this position of people pleasing, you are using a lot of energy to do that, and it's very exhausting. So what ends up falling to the wayside is the things that you need to take care of for yourself, such as taxes, such as looking at budgets, such as looking at bills, because you've exhausted so much energy taking care of everyone else. And the reason why we use two different titles to explain this financial codependency or financial fawning is because fawning actually describes what's really happening when these patterns of behavior show up. And that is that you are in a trauma response. So fawning is one of the main trauma responses that folks can experience, and mostly marginalized identities. So women, for example, can be more likely to experience a fawn response over a fight, flight, or freeze response. And fawning is essentially just like people pleasing in order to stay safe.
And it's interesting, right? We hear that a lot when it comes to social media, right? And like the pressure that people feel to be part of something because of what they're seeing in social media. And they may agree to go on a trip, or they may agree to go to dinner with friends regularly, or like the things where they can't afford it, but they want to please their friends. They don't want to miss out, right, on the things that are going on. So I think that definitely is a big one. Well, we talked briefly about financial literacy skills, but they're very, very important. And I know you spent a lot of time, Chantel, as a consultant in this area. So I want to hear your advice for listeners on that when we come back. Please stay with us.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Money with BDO's Nancy Snedden. Listen live Saturdays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 7 p.m.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Money here on VOCM. I'm your host, Nancy Snedden, licensed insolvency trustee with BDO Canada, right here in Newfoundland and Labrador. My guest today is Chantel Chapman. She's the CEO and co-founder of The Trauma of Money. And we've been focusing on money and how we feel about it, and as well as our behaviors, of course, when it comes to money. And Chantel, you've been sharing so much great advice on how it impacts our behavior. And of course, being aware is the first step to changing behavior and making a positive change. So that takes us to a topic of financial literacy, because I know these days it really is top of mind for so many people, and there are so many opportunities now for growing your financial literacy skills. So what advice can you share with listeners on this?
So I am a very firm believer that financial literacy is actually not accessible to people who are in a trauma activated state or a state of scarcity. And this is one thing that we get wrong over and over again when people are experiencing experiencing extreme financial distress and they don't even have enough money to make their bills, that we think that financial literacy is the solution. Their brain is exhausted. They're not going to be able to absorb it. It's, you're putting too much on their plate to say, well, you just need more financial literacy. So what we always say is we need to support their nervous system. We also need to put out the immediate fires that are present because of scarcity. So when scarcity is there, what happens is we can kind of go into a tunnel. Oftentimes, financial literacy is mostly associated with maybe longer term planning. So to go into longer term planning for someone who's like, I can't even make my rent this month, it's just, it's not going to have an impact. So my advice to anyone who ever teaches financial literacy is to take into consideration those steps before, you know, going into that area of education. You know, what does that person need right now? And what can we do to support that person right now? So that feels very important to say. And in our Trauma of Money method, we have a 6-step method for working with your finances. And we actually don't get into any financial literacy until step 5. So we have 4 steps before we even go there. Because if someone walks into, you know, an education session and they get triggered or activated by, you know, money itself, all of a sudden they're losing access to parts of the brain where they're able to receive that financial literacy education at all. So what can we do to support the nervous system, bring that those parts of the brain back online, address any immediate needs that they have, and then open up that spaciousness in the brain for the financial literacy to actually have an impact? Because it's important. It's just not, you know, to go at it first is just not always the most impactful thing.
Yeah, so I guess you need to be prepared to get the information, absorb the information, take it in, be able to use it, right? Or else it's not landing, right, in a way that's going to be beneficial.
It actually can be harmful to people because if someone's feeling very overwhelmed and then they're like bombarded with new information and that new information creates feelings of shame, it can result in that person shutting down and, you know, going into a little bit of a collapse state where they feel even lower about themselves and then go and avoid their finances even more. So, you know, that's why acknowledging and like meeting people where they're at, rather than giving like blanket financial literacy advice, is really, really important. You know, and I'll just share a little story about myself. When I was going through my own like trauma recovery journey, I had a lot of behaviors with money that were really hard, like credit card debt and avoiding and people pleasing and all this thing. And I started going to trauma therapy because I knew the financial literacy in and out. It didn't shift anything for me long term. And when I started going to therapy, the therapist would often tell me, well, have you tried budgeting? And I was like, do you know what I do for a living? Like, I know how to budget. And, you know, even some of our mental health practitioners in this world, they're so conditioned, like, well, if you're having money problems, go do the budget, you know, go engage in financial literacy. And it just, you know, I was desperate. I got to the point, I'm like, I need something more than that because I've tried it and it's just not shifting anything. And this is why we always say like financial literacy comes after healing some of the relationship with money.
Yeah, it's really looking at the root cause, right? As opposed to thinking that there's a simple solution for what's going on, because that's not always going to be the case. Well, we're almost at final thoughts, but just before we get there, Chantal, I know there's some parents listening out there, and, you know, like I talked about earlier, I hear from so many people that they didn't learn about money. They didn't learn the good, the bad, like the things that they should be considering when it comes to money. So if you had a piece of advice that you could leave for parents with regards to the influence maybe that they're having on their kids that they may not be aware of, what would that be?
Well, Money is a complicated topic for a lot of children, especially younger children. And so many parents really want to do the right thing and teach their kids good lessons about money. But if the child is too young to not fully understand like how money actually works, the child is going to be not so much listening to your words, but more watching your nervous system around what you're saying. And children co-regulate with their parents' nervous systems. So if you go to teach your child a lesson around money and you're kind of activated and you're like, I really want them to know this lesson because I didn't know this lesson, the child is going to probably receive less of the lesson and more of your nervous system activation. So what we always say to parents is when you're teaching lessons about money, try to bring your own nervous system into a space that's more like regulated and more neutral. Don't be like overly excited, and of course don't bring in like anger and like this is a hard lesson you need to learn. The more like regulated and balanced you are, the better the child will be able to receive the lesson.
Yeah, so fascinating, honestly. This whole topic is so fascinating to me. There's so many things to consider, right, when you're looking at these things and behaviors and thoughts about money. It's been really great having you on the show, Chantal, but we do have some time now for some final thoughts. So if you had a final piece of advice that you could share with our listeners, what would that be?
To remember that financial shame loves to isolate us and make us think that we're the only people that have it and that everyone else is doing better with their money than we are. And that is a quality of financial shame, and it doesn't mean that it's true. So if you're experiencing that, one of the antidotes to shame is connection. So talk to someone that you trust about it and open up, or even read, you know, stories on Reddit or in different forums where people are talking about their own shame and experiences so you can feel not so alone. Because that's truly one of the interventions. Shame isolates, and to move away from that, we move into pro-social connection.
Yeah, I think that's some great advice. I tell people that all the time. Like when I'm giving interviews myself, right? Like people often feel like they can't reach out for help, and so they sit on it, which is not good for their mental health, right? We know finance problems are, you know, one of the leading causes of depression and, you know, many forms of anxiety, and to your point, these other traumas. So, you know, it's important to reach out and get some help, and know that you're not alone, right? If you look at all the stories that are in the media right now about cost of living and, you know, the level of insolvency increasing and delinquencies on debt repayments and all those things, it's clear that so many people are struggling. So people certainly are not alone. So Chantal, thanks again for coming on the show. If listeners wanted to reach out for some advice or learn more about the trauma of money, how did they do that?
Thank you so much, Nancy. Yeah, they would go to our website, www.thetraumaofmoney.com.
That's great. And of course, I always want to hear from you, our listeners. If you have a comment or a question that you'd like me to discuss on Your Money, please reach out to yourmoney@bdo.ca or give me a call at 800-563-8337. Until next week, I'm Nancy Sneddon. Stay safe and be well, everyone.
If you have a question or comment, send an email to yourmoney@bdo.ca. This has been Your Money with Nancy Sneddon of BDO, Licensed Insolvency Trustees on Your VOCM.